women can also use the get as a means to affect change in their relationship and to get to a place that they want to be in the divorce litigation.
Welcome to episode 12 of the Let's Get Serious podcast. Today, I bring you a really fascinating interview with the one and only Eliana Baer, a frum female divorce lawyer based in New Jersey, and notably the first female guest on this podcast. So congratulations. We speak about men's issues when it comes to divorce, including the interplay with religious considerations. We speak about what's killing frum marriages. Is it lack of education, in-laws, religiosity, finances, materialism, and other things? We talk about how to achieve an amicable divorce. Bottom line, do not go to court unless you have to. Some interesting legal cases and even legal issues to consider before getting married, especially for the second time. And important spoilers for fathers listening. If you don't listen to the whole episode, at least know this. Eliana highly recommends that you never leave your marital residence or the children until litigation is settled, and do not finalize a divorce with a get until everything is settled. And just an editorial note, I recorded this episode before a couple of recent New Jersey appellate court rulings came out that have big implications for religious divorce cases, so I definitely hope to have Eliana back on the podcast to talk about those. But for now, let's cue the intro and get to the episode.
You're listening to the Let's Get Serious podcast, the relationship podcast for frum men, single, married, separated, divorced. There's something here for the whole chevra. Here's your host, Natan Gettysburg.
Hi, Eliana. Welcome to the Let's Get Serious podcast. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me. Really glad to be here.
So I was wondering if we could start with a little bit of your background and what you do as a divorce lawyer, or, you know, actually, I don't want to put a title to it. Let me know what exactly you do.
Right. Not to bury the lead. I'm a divorce lawyer. I've been practicing for about a decade and a half. I grew up in the frum community, actually in Teaneck, New Jersey. And I went to Berea for high school, Stern College, and then on to Seton Hall Law School. And that was about 2008 where I graduated, and I kind of wanted to be a tax lawyer. But when I got to Fox Rothschild, a world-class family law attorney took me under his wing, and I really saw the fulfillment that you can get from this area of law as opposed to other areas of law, where let's say you're working with numbers or working with big corporations, because you get to affect human life in such a unique way. People are going through a very dark time in their lives, and you get to see them through the other side of it. And that reward in terms of career satisfaction is not something everybody gets, but I'm really glad that I chose this area of law, and I'm glad that I went down this path. And also, as the years went on, because I grew up in the frum community, I started working with a lot of clients from other frum communities in New Jersey. And I'm barred in New York, but I do mostly limit my practice to New Jersey. So right now I work with the frum communities in Lakewood, Teaneck, Highland Park, Elizabeth, and all of those surrounding areas. And it's been really fulfilling and really a unique journey, I would say.
And are your clients mostly frum couples? Or, I mean, I assume you actually would deal with only one of them. So I guess my question is a little bit about like your clientele. Do you deal mostly with frum men, frum women?
I deal with the frum community quite a bit. I'm not limited to men or to women. I think each men and women have their own unique considerations. But in the frum community in general, I think couples do have certain considerations that they need their divorce attorney to get off the bat and to issue spot for them. For example, if you're talking about splitting Sukkot, not everybody knows their first days, the last days on Chol HaMoed in between. And I think people don't want to sit and explain these things to their divorce lawyer. So it's a unique area of the law, and certainly comes with its own set of issues, set of considerations, and something that you really need to be on the ball about, because you could miss something that's really critical for the frum community, like a year in Israel, right? So who pays for the year in Israel? Those are things that could be included in a divorce agreement or in any request of basin or civil court that not everybody might spot if they're not attuned to the issues. So yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. People in the frum community are very comfortable working with me. and have this sense of relief when they come to me, and I kind of just like instinctually get it.
I imagine also it would be helpful in court to have someone who can on the spot think of issues and, you know, understand immediately something that's brought up by the other side, whether it's, you know, something about a holiday that's split or the timing, or, you know, judges don't know about when holidays start or what restrictions apply about, you know, maybe driving somewhere.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Being able to answer off the cuff without having to confer with my client in the middle of an oral argument, something so simple even that we all take for granted, such as summer camp. Right. In the secular world, summer camp tends to be a luxury item. It's something that if two parents can really afford it and there's been a history of it during the marriage, perhaps we'll send our kids to sleepaway camp when it comes time for summer. And they're very expensive and it's really a top shelf type of item. But in the from community, obviously things are a little bit different. And you wouldn't necessarily know that if you hadn't grown up in the firm community or if you're not attuned to the practices and needs of children in the firm community who basically all go to sleepaway camp. So if you're not going to sleepaway camp, it's an outlier versus the other way around. Whereas in the secular community, it's not for everyone.
So practically speaking, is that something that is covered in the law? Like as a lawyer, How do you, I guess, reconcile these practices, I guess, in our community with what the law covers? I mean, from what I imagine, I don't think there's a provision in the law that says parents must send their kids to summer camp. How do you deal with that as when a couple is divorcing and I don't know, maybe there might be enough money or maybe not enough money, but one part of the couple wants to live this sort of, you know, high-end, typical orthodox lifestyle. And one of them says, you know, I'm not interested in that anymore. And I don't want to pay this kind of money. How does that work within the secular legal system?
I wish I could give you one answer on that, but everything in family law is so fact specific and so situational that you can't really answer a yes or no to a question like that. Meaning one party wants to not live that lifestyle anymore and the other party does. The question ultimately becomes, and this standard is in effect in every state, although there are different factors. What is in the best interest of the child? Judges are not consistent, and it's not a criticism. It's just a fact because best interest of the child is such a nebulous standard. Obviously, there are factors, but again, there's always a catch-all. You know, any other consideration that a court might feel furthers the best interest of the child would be something that can and should be considered in the context of these type of requests. So for instance, yeshiva tuition, camp expenses, Pesach programs, things like that. I don't know that any judge would really order somebody to pay for a Pesach program, but you know, stranger things have happened. But certainly in terms of camp, school, things of that nature, a judge might look at what was the standard of living during the marriage? What was the practice during the marriage? Is it better for the children to be consistent with their upbringing? If they've spent the first 11, 12 years of their lives going to a yeshiva and the firm community, it's very difficult for a judge to say, okay, forget that practice that the parties engaged in agreed during the marriage that they would, you know, do for their children in favor of one party's objection at the time of the divorce. These issues are the most complex issues that I encounter, meaning one person no longer wants to live the firm lifestyle, which is their right. It is a free country, obviously. Everybody can choose.
Just to clarify, I didn't necessarily mean like they don't want to be religious anymore. I meant like they don't necessarily want to take on the materialistic side of what is our religious community has sort of evolved into.
Yeah, I think that would be, again, consistent with the best interests of the child. Is it in the best interest of this child to continue on this path, doing all the extras, let's call them, for lack of a better word, doing all the extras that come along with being from? I don't know that a judge has the authority to order specific luxuries, but certainly if money is not an object, if money is an object, it becomes a totally different analysis. But if the parents have the financial wherewithal to satisfy these expenses, a judge might well say, keep going with it, keep doing it because this is what the children expect. This is what they're used to. Again, assuming the family finances are in line with these types of expenses and continuing these types of expenses, I think a judge would be hard pressed to say, okay, one party has now decided it's no longer in the child's best interest. But why? Mm-hmm. You know, why is it? I don't want to do it is probably not a sufficient answer.
Right, right. I have so many questions, I guess, on this thing. I don't want to spend too much time on it because we're so limited, but I know it's probably a really interesting topic. But one quick scenario that comes up in my mind, suppose you have a couple that get divorced when the child is young and has not yet gone to a Jewish day school, and they have never paid that kind of tuition. So there's no pattern there. Does that kind of thing get ordered by the judge? Can the judge say you have to suddenly start paying tuition if one of the parents says, we've never set them on any path yet, and I don't want to pay this kind of private school tuition? What would happen in that kind of case?
Again, it would be incredibly fact specific in mm-hmm. terms of the child's surrounding atmosphere, in terms of what's best for the child. Does the child have any special needs that maybe a yeshiva can't service? There are all kinds of considerations that would go into it, but private school tuition is not an obligation specifically in New Jersey, meaning if one mm-hmm. parent wants to send their child to private school, it's not a given that that's going to happen, especially in districts with very good public schools. And a judge might not understand the nuance of that situation, that basically, if you go to shul and you want your child to have friends in shul, you send the child to similar schools. But on the other hand, there's the flip side of the coin, which is it's a tremendous financial burden. And even for intact families, they're struggling on a day-to-day basis to pay for yeshiva tuition. And people are in all kinds of crippling debt just to do this. I mean, this is a rabbit hole, because I can go down the rabbit hole for hours about the non-viability of the yeshiva system, only to the extent that it's just cost prohibitive for the average family. I mean, even if you're earning a nice income, you're basically the working poor if you have four kids in yeshiva. So to pitch to a judge, and again, this analysis is totally different in Beis Din, because in Beis Din, I think their proclivity is obviously yeshiva education, but in a court, things are different. And probably 90% of these judges have gone to public school and they are successful. They don't necessarily elevate the yeshiva education above all, particularly to the extent that it's completely unaffordable for the average family, especially if you have multiple children. So I think that a judge would be hard pressed to say, yeah, you know, you make, let's say, $50,000 a year, but go ahead and spend $25,000 a year on this one child's education, and maybe to the detriment of the children to follow. I don't know what would happen in the end, but I know that a lot of considerations would kind of go into this pot of soup that a judge needs to sift through and say, well, what do I do with this case? And I don't envy a judge that needs to do that, because there are a lot of cultural considerations, a lot of cultural expectations in terms of how the parties grew up. Did they go to private school? There are a lot of things that a court would consider in that instance. But at the end of the day, a lot of times it'll come down to economics. And we all know the economics of yeshiva tuition do not work in court or out of court. It doesn't work anywhere.
Right. So on the topic that you brought up about, like, just how frum families are struggling financially and all that, let me segue into this question. Why do you see frum marriages breaking down?
Yeah, there's no one reason. I mean, much like the general population, everybody has their own reason that they get divorced, and none are right and none are wrong. They just are a series of unfortunate events that tend to unfold throughout these people's marriage, typically manifesting right from the beginning. And a lot of times, because of the segregation of the sexes in Judaism from preschool on, you have this inability to relate to the opposite sex in some sense. And that's not across the board. That's just, if you ask me to pinpoint something that I see frequently, it's dysfunction typically from the beginning of the marriage. And a lot of times it can manifest in sexual dysfunction, meaning they're taught the halachot, but they're not taught how to relate to the other person on a basic intimate level outside of the halachot. And I think that's doing a lot of these young people who are getting married a lot of disservice, right? They get married very young. They have not had a chance to develop their frontal cortex or whatever area of the brain is most mature. during those years in older adolescence, young adulthood, and they develop patterns in their relationships that are really very unhealthy. And it tends to escalate throughout the marriage. Another thing that I see often is involvement of in-laws, parents, whatever it is. And typically, and not to stereotype, but it's usually the more wealthy family that is very involved with the couple from the beginning. And the involvement at the beginning might seem okay, but then it just gets more and more intrusive. And as the years go on, because you're developing your own family, and at that point you almost want to cut the ties or just go out on your own and have your own family and have your own life. And you're still constrained by these purse strings on the part of one of the families. These are just patterns that I see emerging in the context mm-hmm. of from divorce, but definitely, you know, something I see pretty regularly. And again, it's mm-hmm. not everybody. Everybody stands on their unique facts. Sometimes mm-hmm. also you have people leaving the firm community, which tends to be a catalyst to divorce, because it's very, I've seen people do it where one party's not from and the other party is from. I think mm-hmm. it's very difficult, and it's a fundamental issue, meaning if fundamentally mm-hmm. you have no consensus on religion and the religious upbringing of your children, it creates a lot of strife in a marriage that ultimately mm-hmm. tends to lead to divorce. So these are the patterns that I see. Again, not everybody. Some people just have bad marriages, just like the rest of the population, and they're mm-hmm. entitled to get out of those bad marriages for a variety of reasons. And it's never one party or the other. It's usually the combination of these two people. And sometimes they're really well-meaning people and really nice people, but it's just a very unfortunate situation that ultimately leads them to a divorce.
Wow, that's really interesting. And yeah, there's no real data there, because, you know, there's no like form to fill out explaining exactly why the marriage is over. I'm wondering, as a divorce attorney, do you ever see a situation where you recommend to your client that they first see if the marriage is fixable before they proceed forward with a divorce?
I usually do that, unless the situation is so broken on its face that either somebody is in a dangerous situation going back into the marriage, or they're on another bad path if they were to try again, or the situation is just so egregious that obviously this is a divorce situation. By the time people come and seek out a divorce lawyer, usually they've already been through all that process. But if I see somebody having doubts about the process, I will never recommend that somebody move forward with it just to move forward with it. I will always recommend, if you can save your marriage, especially if there are children involved, that's plan A. And you can have a good functional marriage, meaning don't go back into a bad marriage, right? That doesn't serve anybody, including the children. But if you could make it work in a functional, healthy way, absolutely. I would always say, try to work on the marriage, plan A. And then plan B is for the children to have two separate happy homes instead of one really unhappy, intact family, an intact home.
That's great. I really think that's a good thing, because I think a lot of divorce lawyers, especially who are not from and not really part of the community, don't have that at all as one of their values. And as soon as you go to see one, they immediately want you to sign a retainer agreement and begin the litigation. So, and a lot of people do run to divorce lawyers before really trying some more practical steps. You mentioned in-laws as an example, or financial stresses, or even religious differences, which are not an end all. I did hear a recent podcast by David Beshevkin, shout out, and he interviewed couples who are split on their religious. One is not religious at all, one is religious, and how they make the marriage work. And I think that's a very interesting listen if anybody wants to check that out and see how that could work. As long as there's a lot of mutual respect and love, those differences don't have to break up a family.
I totally agree with you. And I'm actually going to listen to that, because I think it would take two very level-headed people to say, okay, I understand we have these differences, because people want to be right. At the end of the day, people want to mm-hmm. be right. There's this need, especially when you have a bad marriage, to argue about anything and everything. But people who actually have huge differences and make it work probably suggest they're two very healthy, communicative people who can function in this space that not many people can function in. So that's sure. really impressive.
Yeah, it's really beautiful. So just staying on this topic a little bit, what would you say to a listener who's facing divorce? How do they reach an amicable divorce? What are the things, what are the steps you need to take to make it peaceful and to avoid litigation and any of the messy stuff?
Yeah, so there's always a downside to litigation, right? Despite the fact that I am a litigator by nature, I think that if you can resolve your dispute without resort to litigation, you should. Meaning, if there are two good faith people on each side, you can't do it if there's one bad actor, right? If somebody's really out to get you, you can't come to the table and say, okay, let's negotiate a deal. Because number one, the deal might not be fair. And number two, even if you reach a fair deal, they're not going to abide by it. So if you have two well-meaning people who really want to settle their divorce, my go-to is always mediation. You have to find a lawyer, first and foremost, who is not adverse to it. Because some lawyers will just say, oh, you want to get divorced? Let's file a complaint for divorce immediately. I always give people the option. That's my practice to say, I can file a complaint for divorce. That's litigation. That sets you on the court path. So if you want to resolve this amicably, that may or may not be the path for you. You're not precluded from going down a settlement path if you do file a complaint for divorce. But it's kind of a shot across the bow. This is how I'm escalating in this fashion. Or in the alternative, I tell people, I can write a nice letter, again, firm, but nice and pleasant, saying, I've been retained. We'd like to work out an amicable resolution. To that end, we'd like to attend mediation. Please let us know if you'd be amenable, if you'd be open to that possibility. And 9 times out of 10, people will say, yeah, I'm open to that possibility. And without ever stepping foot into a courtroom, we can come to a comprehensive settlement that is in everybody's best interest. Again, assuming there are two well-meaning people on each side, you can effect that type of resolution. And I would always recommend it above litigation, because litigation is costly, it's time consuming. And, you know, people tell me, Eliana, hey, aren't you talking yourself out of work? You're a lawyer, it's your bread and butter. Don't you want to litigate? Yeah, there are plenty of opportunities to litigate, but I'd rather people come out of this whole system satisfied with the fact that they took the path that was right for them and their family, and make that referral to the next person and say, hey, Eliana's not going to ramp up your case unnecessarily. Of course, there's a time and a place for litigation if somebody's acting poorly and it needs to be addressed by a judge. Absolutely, it should be. There are some cases that are either unsettleable in general or unsettleable, at least for now, until everybody comes to the table and starts acting in good faith. But mediation is always the best bet for somebody who wants to resolve their case without the tears and financial obligation that comes with litigation.
Right. So next question, I'm wondering, what are some of the things men, or, you know, from men, but I guess men in general, should watch out for in the divorce process? And just to add to that, like, suppose you're representing a man and the lawyer on the other side is very aggressive and they're known for aggressive tactics. What are some things that you would say to your client in terms of things that he should look out for, precautions he should take, how to protect himself against false allegations? Or should he make sure to spend more time with the children than he might otherwise have because of work, just to make sure that, you know, an argument is not going to be made that he's not the primary caretaker? You know, there's probably so many things. Like, what would you say to a man facing divorce, you know, in terms of these, like, things he should look out for and be aware of?
That's a great question. And in saying what I'm about to say, I don't want to minimize anything in terms of get abuse or victims of actual get withholding husband to wife. However, caveat, there is a flip side to that. In terms of women can also use the get as a means to affect change in their relationship and to get to a place that they want to be in the divorce litigation. And what do I mean by that? Because you often hear about get abuse in terms of husband to wife, husband's withholding the get. What a so-and-so, I can't believe he's doing that. Clarum, whatever, like that's typically what you hear. But there are other ways this can manifest in the opposite direction. For example, many people tend to live together during a divorce proceeding. It's just financially responsible. It's like living with your parents during, you know, law school or whatever. It's financially responsible. It's not ideal. It's not where you want to be, but we haven't resolved the finances yet. We haven't resolved custody yet. We need to stay in the same house, which is what the general population does typically. In at least half of my cases, we have couples that are living together through the bitter end of their divorce, which could take years, but this is the situation they find themselves in. Sometimes a woman could say, I want the get now, while she's living with her husband. And there are ways that can be done if your house is big enough, and if you have a separate apartment attached to your house or whatever it is, there are ways that can be done. But if you have a standard size house with, you know, a few kids, there's nothing that can be done in terms of giving a get while the divorce is going on. And a lot of people might be up in arms about that and might say, that's get withholding. The second that there's a mention of a get, you have to give it. Perhaps, and everybody should consult with the rabbinic authorities on that particular matter from a halachic perspective. But from a legal perspective, I have to advise my male clients, do not give a get until you can leave the house. Because once you give a get, and I'm not a rabbi, obviously, but you're going to run into some problems. So in conjunction, and there are ways that it can be done. So I try to work with the ways that it can be done, but sometimes you just can't fit, you know, a square peg into a round hole and it can't be done. So, you know, obviously everybody has to act within their comfort level and talk to a rabbi about what needs to be done in those types of situations. But from a legal perspective, just like I would advise a secular client, my advice can't change with somebody in the firm community, right? From a legal perspective, mm-hmm. do not leave that house. So, mm-hmm. you know, that's one of the issues that we need to navigate, because it could really give somebody a leg up in terms of financial issues, in terms of custody. The man might not have another place to go. Mm-hmm. Or you have time with the kids, right? If he moves into his parents' basement and he has four kids, I don't know that he's getting significant time with those children before the finances are settled, before custody is settled. It creates a very big issue from a legal perspective in terms of preserving rights and obligations. Mm-hmm. So again, it's not a recommendation. It's just issue spotting. We're spotting issues. So that's an issue that I would say absolutely look out for. And consult with your lawyer and your rabbi to figure out how to navigate, because that's a tough one.
Okay. So it sounds like a big warning is to men is don't leave the house. If I would summarize.
I mean, yes, unless finances and custody are worked out, or unless you have 100% faith in your spouse to act fairly without an agreement in place, which obviously if you're at the point of divorce, there's could be a lack of trust. I don't know, but right. Tends to be.
they correlate, I'm sure.
They absolutely do. So unless you can have full faith in your spouse to act appropriately with custody and with financial issues, it would be the recommendation to stay put. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I'm wondering, you know, you mentioned, we talked a little bit about civil court and we mentioned Beis Din. What do you think is the better form for a man? I mean, obviously, you know, ideally, these are all fair forms and everything's supposed to be equal. But in reality, there's probably some advantage to going to secular court or going to a Beis Din, assuming mediation doesn't work out. So if you have a male client, what do you recommend? Where should he go?
So I can't say with certainty, don't go to this forum over that forum. But there are things that I would take into consideration when making my recommendation. Obviously, everybody has their own religious level. Everybody has their own comfort level. And if you need a heter to go to civil court, that's something that we would work with. And we would need to navigate the reasons as to why civil court would be appropriate in a given case. So what reasons would civil court be more appropriate? If there are young children, for better or worse, and this is not a criticism, but Beis Din tends to be less of a 50-50 split in terms of custody. there tends to be some proclivity toward the mother in terms of keeping the children status quo. Again, that's not a criticism because, and this is going to sound like a generalization, and it is. So fair warning, women tend to be home with their children, whereas men tend not to be. Women tend to may keep the house in the event of a divorce. And sometimes children want to stay on their block, right? That's a big thing. They want to stay on their block. They want to live with their friends. And the nature of a Jewish household is not, you know, everybody on their devices at night. Sometimes it could be everybody out on the street at night playing. And there's a big part of that that can be missing if they're a 50-50 custody split. That's not to say that that's worse or better, because obviously the relationship with the parent is far more important than the relationship between kids on the street. Those relationships with parents cannot be replaced. And that's paramount. So if you're a man that has been more involved with the kids and wishes to stay more involved with the kids, you would need to really understand and know which beis din you're going to, who are the dayanim, who are you getting that's going to decide your case? Are they more pro-mother? On the other hand, you can have a situation where a dayan may say in beis din, yeah, the boy is of bar mitzvah age, needs to be with the father on Shabbos. Every Shabbos, doesn't matter. Parties need to live within walking distance. Every Shabbos, boy needs to be with the father. That's something you wouldn't get in civil court. So there are a lot of considerations here. Another is financial considerations in terms of alimony. beis din does not award alimony, but that doesn't mean that you're necessarily going to come out better if you're a man. And again, huge generalizations, because you're assuming that man is going to pay alimony to the woman versus the other way around. And child support, you know, all the support obligations are going to be on the man. And again, it's a generalization. There are plenty of women who pay alimony to their husbands or child support to their husbands. But typically, especially in the frum community, it tends to be the other way around, where husbands are paying to their wives. So beis din cannot award alimony, but doesn't mean he's going to pay less, because he'll probably pay more in child support to account for that and maybe have 100% tuition obligation or something of that nature. Whereas in civil court, a tuition obligation would be shared between the parties, and there could be alimony, yes, but alimony would be included in the income for the wife. So the percentage splits and the child support could go down. There are huge, minute considerations that all of the above needs to go into this decision, but it needs somebody who completely understands the nuances here, because a lot of these issues you wouldn't necessarily know about or anticipate. But if you work in both worlds, if you work in the secular world and the firm world, you know that there's no one right answer and it all has to fit the facts of the case, but you have to be able to spot the issues to be able to guide your client accordingly.
Yeah, I could definitely see why it's important to have somebody with experience. And it's so interesting how, as you mentioned right at the beginning, how this is so fact intensive. Every single case is a totally different picture. And I could see why that makes this a pretty exciting area of law. It's not just, you know, applying corporate tax formulas. I mean, this is like how many kids, which schools they go to, what the neighborhood looks like, what the jobs are of the parents, you know, lifestyle. There's so much that goes into it.
Yeah, there are no two cases that are alike. It's constantly keeping me on my toes, which is great.
Right. I guess I'll go back to what you mentioned before about leaving the house and, you know, how that could affect the get. Because, you know, one of the themes of a firm divorce is that there's religious marriage and that there's, when it ends, there's a get given. So I was happy that you mentioned the fact that a get is, you know, used by women too, because a lot of times I think in the general chatter out there is that a get is a man's tool, and a man can, you know, choose to refuse it and then just, you know, move on with a rosy life. But in reality, that's not actually true, because in halacha, a man gives a get, yes, but the woman also has to receive the get, and a woman can also refuse to receive a get and then keep the man hostage. I mean, there are some very, very extreme loopholes that the man could go through by getting 100 rabbis to sign on from many different countries. And it's very, very complicated and extremely rare. So essentially, it's a tool of mutual consent. You know, both the husband and wife do have to consent to a religious divorce. So my question is, are there any other situations besides just when it comes to leaving the house? Do you think there are other situations where a husband or even a wife should hold off on performing the get ceremony until something else is done? And I guess, you know, custody or finance, some other conditions besides just leaving the house. Is it ever appropriate?
Is it ever appropriate? I would say no. It is typically not appropriate from my perspective. And this is just my opinion, but using the get as a bargaining chip is never something that I would be okay with. I think there are conscientious objectors out there in terms of, well, a court compelled me to do it, now I can't, something of that nature that I tend to hear. But on the other hand, yes, you can, right? You can do it. If you're not living together and everything is broken off in terms of any concerns about ichud or anything of that nature, I would say sooner rather than later should be the rule. Obviously, there are situations that could be unique that I'm not considering at this point in time. But if those situations do arise, everybody should talk to their local Orthodox rabbi and get some kind of guidance on the issue. From my perspective, it's just not okay to use the get as a bargaining chip other than to navigate logistical issues, right? Like I physically can't give you the get because we're living together. That's a valid thing to say.
But I mean, on that example, like if you take that example of the couple still living in the same house, I mean, it really can be the same case. So let's say, for example, we have a husband and wife in the same house. They want to get divorced. And the husband says, okay, well, I can't leave the house, so I can't give you a get. And then what if the wife says, or what if the husband offers, okay, I'll leave, but I won't give you the get until custody is resolved. So that way, you know, I leave the house, you get the house to yourself, but as your promise to me, you won't make me do a get until I make sure that, you know, the children, I have the children at least, you know, a fair amount of the time, and I still maintain my rights as if I was living in the house. And then he moves out. And then what if she changes her mind and says, well, now I want the get. So, I mean, it's the same example. He's just, you know, instead of to reduce tension, let's say he says, okay, I'll move out for now, but I want to maintain the rights as if I stayed in the house. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah. I mean, it makes sense from a fact pattern perspective, but from a giving the get perspective, if there's no halakhic consideration there that prevents it, and no legal issues to be preserved, I don't think you can condition one on the other. But again, a lot will depend on the facts of the case. And, you know, if you ask this question, this is more of a halakhic question rather than a legal question, because legally, there are plenty of people who move out of their houses without a custody arrangement in place, and it creates all sorts of headaches and nightmares. But it tends to happen, and the get is really irrelevant to that whole situation. Whereas if you're talking about somebody actually living together, the get is very relevant. But as soon as the get loses its relevance in terms of, I can't do this because of, you know, halakhic considerations, I think it would be appropriate if you have a specific concern to speak to a rabbi versus a lawyer, because it's not a legal issue at that point. I can't counsel anybody, yeah, you should not give the get until X, Y, and Z occurs, other than in a situation where it would cause you to relinquish a legal right by virtue of, well, we can't live together anymore.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I guess it's both, because you're saying if you give a get, then halakhically, that means you have to move out, but then that has legal effects.
Correct. So those two issues are very intertwined, but it becomes less intertwined when people are living separately. You almost lose the relevance of the get in that situation, the legal relevance of the get.
The legal relevance of the get has legal relevance?
Only to the extent that it would cause somebody to move out of the house. And that has that has a legal effect.
Right.
But as soon as you remove that legal effect, that's out of my hands at that point. Then I say, this is not a question for a lawyer. This is a question for a rabbi.
Mm-hmm. Kind of just to summarize, I guess I know your answer, but I want to just put it into a direct question. Are there any dangers for a man to give a get immediately when it's requested? Besides, I mean, are there any reasons that he should?
Yeah, I mean, as soon as somebody wants it after separating, right? I mean, if a man wants to give it, perhaps, I don't know. It would depend on the specific situation.
Right. Okay.
Which is a frustrating answer, but it's an answer we get very frequently because everything's so fact specific.
So just to summarize, what do you think should be the timing of a get in the divorce process?
So that, of course, depends on the situation. I know it's frustrating to hear it depends on the situation, but that's really what it is. Every case is very fact specific, and we would need to work with rabbis to determine halachically what is the right answer here, right? I don't think any individual, man or woman, should take it upon themselves individually to say, I'm not giving the get until X, Y, and Z occurs, because you've not done that in conjunction with your lawyer and your rabbi. So everybody needs to be involved and on board with this decision. And it can't be kind of like an ad hoc, well, I'm going to decide not to give it until the following conditions are met. It really needs to be something, number one, that is never used as a tool for coercive control. That's first and foremost on any side, man or woman. And number two, needs to be timed in connection with your lawyer and your rabbi in all situations.
Well, just to push back a tiny bit on that, in terms of, like, you know, the get being something to do with coercive control, there is a lot of gray area in the middle. I mean, there are unfortunately stories of people, I guess primarily men, but no, I've seen cases of women as well, especially in Israel, who use the get as an extortive tool. So get your wealthy father or relative to pay me some exorbitant amount of money, and then I'll give you a get, or I'll accept the get. But in a lot of cases, there's really a big gray area. And, you know, I'm wondering, do you think that there are any egregious situations where the husband or wife should exercise their halachic right to say whether or not they consent to these conditions? Isn't that why the get exists in the first place? That one side can't just impose it on the other. A man can't forcibly divorce his wife, and a husband could only very rarely be forced to give his wife a divorce. So do you think there are no situations in the middle where you would say, like, okay, you should not give a get yet until you have the basics, or you should not accept the get yet until he tells you the basics of the financial, of where all your money went, or something like that? Does that make any sense to you?
Yes, it does. And there are certainly gray areas. There are 100% gray areas. But at the end of the day, if you're using the get, if one is using get as a bargaining chip, as saying, I won't give a get until these financial concessions are made, or this avenue is gone down, this is disclosed. From a personal perspective, I'm not talking legally at all. I'm not talking legally. I don't know that it's the right answer to hold a get over somebody's head until you do X, Y, and Z, until you fulfill X, Y, and Z. Now, the timing of the get might not just be wrong for a variety of reasons. The timing might be not right, and that's where your gray areas come in. Why is the timing not right? It could be 100 different reasons why the timing is not right, or what conditions some rabbinic authority puts on the granting of a get. I can't speak to that. What I can speak to, and maybe I'm a little bit skewed, because when I see these cases, they tend to be in the context of coercive control, which is a form of domestic violence. So I happen to be very sensitive to this issue in general, but I do 100% agree with you that there are gray areas out there that I cannot fathom or anticipate, that maybe I would say the timing's not right, or some other things need to happen in order for a religious divorce to be halachically appropriate, obviously after consultation with a halachic authority on the issue, which I am not. But, you know, obviously these issues would be dealt with accordingly. And when I am in a pinch and I don't know the answer, I call on people that are wiser than me, you know, at ORA or at Shalom Task Force or these organizations, man or woman, again. And it tells me that, yeah, my gut check is right or my gut check is wrong. So I'm not an expert in the area of get refusal. Again, I typically see it in the context of coercive control, but there can be other situations that exist where I do have to pick up the phone and call somebody at one of these organizations to get more clarity on the issue. But yes, I agree with you that there are definitely gray areas.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so just to go into something a little bit different, what could a man do to protect himself going into a marriage? I guess we could start with a second marriage, because then there's sort of, it's more obvious what he might have to protect himself, more financial considerations. He might already have kids. What do you think that he should look for? Should he have a prenup? You know, how could custody work out if he's getting married to somebody who already has kids? Is that something that you think about or work with? Or once the divorce happens, you're out of the picture?
No, absolutely. And I deal with second marriages quite frequently in the context of my practice. And I always recommend, obviously, I'm a lawyer, so it's a legal device, a prenuptial agreement, to regulate mostly the financial issues, all the financial issues, because in New Jersey, at least, custody, child support, things of that nature can't be determined prior to a marriage. So it would need to be just financial issues. But a lot of times, if both parties have children, it could raise some concerns about risk with a second marriage. So I'll give you an example. Let's say two people get married. It's the man's second marriage, wife's first marriage. The man has a child from a prior relationship, and the woman doesn't, but she, let's say, has a significant estate, a life insurance policy, and some other estate issues that are there, a sizable estate. So they get married, and let's say the woman were to predecease the man. Then if there's no planning tool involved, if there's no will, if there's no prenuptial agreement, everything would go to the husband. And let's say by that time they have two kids of their own, everything goes to the husband. And then if the husband dies, it goes to the three children equally. But you may be wondering, but that might not be fair, because the only inheritance these final two children are going to get is from these two parents. But the other child has another parent somewhere out there, and they're going to get an inheritance from that parent also. Or they're, maybe none of them are over 18, and all three of these kids need to be raised. And now you have equal amounts going to the three children. Whereas maybe the two younger children really need it more, because again, that first child has a living parent still. So these are all considerations that you might not necessarily think of when you're all blissful and trying to get married and, you know, trying to establish this new life, but they're considerations that I think about certainly, and would urge everybody, especially going into a second marriage. With the first marriage, it's not as relevant unless one side has a significant amount of money and wants to protect some family money, whatever the case is, it happens. But certainly with a second marriage, and especially if there are kids involved, having these types of issues worked out in advance is very important, not only for the people who are left behind in the event something terrible happens, but just from a financial planning perspective, so that everybody can arrange their affairs accordingly, so that all children are treated equally, so that all parties are treated fairly, so that premarital assets can be delineated and preserved in the event of a second divorce. These things are quite important.
It's really interesting just how one small example like that have so many ramifications.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And then you touched very briefly on like first marriage. Is there anything that you would recommend somebody, a young man going into his first marriage, or maybe to his parents who might be listening, that he should do to prepare? I mean, like, for example, there's a lot of talk about a halachic prenup. Do you recommend a specific flavor of the halachic prenup, especially like with regard to practicing in New Jersey? I mean, most Jews are either in New York or New Jersey or Israel, but I mean, I think most of my listeners are in those two states. So yeah, I'm just wondering like what you would say to a parent, or what would you recommend to your own son who's looking to get married?
I have three sons actually. So cool. They, you know, I can't imagine any of them getting married at this point, but you know, looking into my future self and what advice I would give them is that, especially in the frum community, I think interacting and understanding the opposite sex is paramount in terms of importance. And if you don't have interaction with the opposite sex, You need to learn. You need to not only learn halacha surrounding all of the pertinent issues that are involved in a marriage, but you need to learn how to interact on a human level, on a communication level that works, and to understand that marriage is not going to be easy, but it's worth the fight a lot of the time, and, you know, go forth with that information. In terms of a halachic prenup, I never think it's a bad idea to enter into a halachic prenup. Now, I think that the statistics are pretty clear on that a get is not an issue in the cases where there is a halachic prenup. So it takes it almost out of consideration. I don't know from a legal perspective, I could go down a rabbit hole on that also, but I won't, as to whether or not, if they were challenged, if this halachic prenup were challenged, whether it would be enforceable or not. But I think it's more of a prophylactic device to ensure that it doesn't become an issue down the line. I think there is an issue in the firm community with get abuse. And I'm not talking one gender or the other. I think it can be used by either gender. Obviously, you know, word on the street, as you said, to coin your phrase, is to treat it as a man to woman issue. It could be both. And a halachic prenup protects both parties. Obviously, if somebody wants to act inappropriately, they can do it regardless. But it's definitely at least a preventative measure that we could take, I suppose, as a community, to take it out of consideration, to try and eliminate the issue before it arises.
Mm-hmm. If it's okay with you for me to get personal, like, is that something, would you want your son to sign a halachic prenup?
I mean, I signed it. So my husband signed it. So I think, yes, I think I would absolutely want him to sign it.
Cool.
Only for better or worse, because it takes it out of the discussion. Right? It's not an issue. It's almost like a regular prenuptial agreement where we understand we don't want this to come to pass. But if it does, we're taking, you know, the following 10 issues out of consideration, and we're going to resolve everything nicely and amicably.
Right. Right. But I mean, to some extent it does, you know, I could tell you from experiences I know, it does like, you know, the get does offer some amount of protection against an egregious actions by either party. And in my opinion, that's why it exists in halacha, why it exists in the first place, so that one party can't unilaterally damage the other and can't abuse the other essentially in an egregious way. And by agreeing to just, you know, eliminate that, I think my understanding of halacha prenups I've seen is that it doesn't say the woman must accept the get right away, but, you know, either way, I think it's easier for the court system to be abused by women. I mean, it goes both ways also, but I think it does slant in that direction. I think you mentioned earlier that it seems like, I don't know if I would want my son to eliminate that as an insurance. I would never want him to extort. First of all, I should never get divorced or anything, obviously, but, you know, it's not a tool of extortion. But isn't there an argument to be made that it should be, that I guess equal footing should be maintained, just in case, like as an insurance policy, God forbid it should ever be needed.
You know, I guess it's my turn to push back, but from a Jewish and from halachic perspective, there really is no equal footing. When you enter into the ketubah, I mean, the halachic prenup is almost proper enforcement of the ketubah. So, and the get is proper enforcement also. So you could go either way, right? You could say, on the one hand, yeah, you're not on equal footing, but you never were on equal footing to begin with. You have this imbalance in halacha somewhat that does tend to lend to more abuses in terms of this particular issue because of this imbalance of power. And again, anybody could use anything as an extortive measure. So I'm not saying it's the get in particular. If you have, you know, a shoelace and somebody's fighting over the shoelace and it's really important to somebody, you could fight over the shoelace and it could go either way. Like, even if you have no ties on your shoes, you're still fighting over the shoelace because it's important to the other person. So this particular issue is just it's almost like a straw man. Yeah, it's important. It's an important issue, but only because it's important to us. In the same way, a shoelace in the example, obviously the shoelace doesn't have halachic implications, and you don't have to consult your rabbi about whether or not you should give the other party the shoelace, but it's the same concept, right? But if there's a power imbalance there, it creates more room for abuse.
Wait, power imbalance being what? Where is the power imbalance? Just to clarify.
So, I mean, I think there's a reason that we see this as more of a male-dominated issue. It's because there's an inherent power imbalance in the ketubah. And again, the ketubah was only created to cure a power imbalance that existed in Tanakh, right? So the power imbalance was such that there was, I think it's in Devar, I don't know where it is exactly. I'll get back to you on that. But where it says, you know, I'm going to use the English just for, you know, everybody who's listening, but a man takes a wife, and suddenly he finds her disgusting. He can cast her out without consequence. So that really started the power imbalance. And then the ketubah was instituted, I think, 2000 years later as a means to somewhat cure that power imbalance. But it's still somewhat, you know, the man has to give the wife the get. That is standard operating procedure. The man has to grant the wife a get, and the wife has to, as a corollary, accept it. We don't, and maybe in Israel things are different, but I suppose in the New York, New Jersey area, you just hear this issue more in the context of a man refusing to give his wife a get for some reason, right? And he's gone on, he's remarried, and typically you'll see that in Israel because there are not very many rabbis who are willing to do a second marriage without, you know, a get in America, but perhaps he's remarried. He's moved on with his life, and the woman is stuck in Aguna, and that's something that is dubbed as a crisis in our community.
Does that ever happen? Does that ever happen other than one or two cases where there's a man who remarries without a get?
I would say it's probably more prevalent in Israel, only because rabbis in America, I think, are more circumspect about marrying somebody who's still halachically married.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think it happens more in Israel than in America, but there are certain cases that are pretty public where the man has moved on with his life and the woman is kind of stuck in this limbo. But again, that's not to say abuses can go both ways, just like assault and battery, right? Which I see in my daily practice in terms of domestic violence. Can a woman assault and batter a man? 100%, but it happens. It happens, but it's more of the exception rather than the rule. Typically, it's the other way around. And again, I can get into issues in society in general as to what could be the catalyst behind this. But at the end of the day, that's just how it's framed because it's how it usually presents. And it's not a criticism of well-meaning men out there who are living in this gray area of their rabbi says it's not the time. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about people who use it as a means for extortion in particular. Those are the people I'm talking about, the bad apples in the world, not the overwhelmingly majority of men who are just trying to reach a fair resolution and are living in a gray area. But again, the people who are using it for extortion, that has no place in society and halacha. Anywhere. And I think that for the large majority of the people, the halachic prenup works. Can there be a situation where a woman is using it as a tool? Absolutely. In the same way, you could use anything as a tool to extort or do whatever you want to do if you don't have good intentions. But if two people are well-intentioned and there's gray area, I've personally never seen a halachic prenup taken to court and enforced. I think that people tend to sign a halachic prenup, work with halachic authorities to determine the timing of the get. And it's not used as a tool of extortion, but it's really, again, a prophylactic measure only for this extortion situation.
Right, right. Yeah, I think that's important because I think that's it's sort of when it comes to a get refusal issue being out there, it seems like the focus is on like, you know, two or three extreme cases. I mean, these cases of extortion are I don't have data, but it, I think it's extremely rare. I think the vast majority of divorces, there's no extortion at all. And if there's a delay on doing a get, it's because the terms have just not been settled. And it has nothing to do with one side trying to extort or abuse the other. But it seems like that's always a danger. And it's sort of kind of the scales have tipped the other way, where it's kind of like now men are threatened with like a publicity campaign. And it's sort of come the opposite in a way, that it's now, it's gone so far the other way that it's sort of a tool that can be used by women to get an advantage in the divorce.
On that note, I can tell you that the organizations that do publicize are very circumspect in the timing of the publication. They are very, well, for liability reasons, and I'm talking, you know, from a legal perspective.
As a lawyer, sure.
Absolutely. That society has become very litigious, in addition to, you know, all the other things we talked about. And if they publicize something before it's time to do so, they could be on the hook. So I think that they're very diligent in terms of knowing the facts of the situation before they do publicize. Do mistakes happen? I'm sure mistakes happen, as with anything. But at the end of the day, I think that they're pretty careful before they say this person is a get refuser and they label them, because that carries a lot of halachic and communal importance. It might not be important to everybody out there, but if you're living in the Jewish community and you want an aliyah shul or whatever, you're going to be fairly careful about that. But again, these organizations, they do get the facts of the situation before they publicize, because of situations where maybe they haven't had all the facts and they publicized too early. I don't know specific cases like that. I'm just saying, hypothetically, that could have happened. And now they're pretty careful about it, from what I know.
Right. Wow. Okay. So, Eliana, you're extremely knowledgeable and well-versed on everything related to divorce, legal, halachic. We touched on so many interesting topics, from the practical, from, you know, just speaking about particular issues that might come up in a firm divorce, all the way down to more theoretical and halachic topics. I really enjoyed this conversation, and I want to just thank you so much for being on this podcast. And also, I would like to give you the opportunity to let people know how to reach you.
Sure. Thanks. And I really enjoy being here. I know it tends to be frustrating, because a lot of times there are very fact-specific issues. But if you ever have a question, you know, you can reach out to me. I'm at etbear@foxrothschild.com. My email address, you can also just do a Google search. You'll come up with my bio and contact information. You can find me on LinkedIn under Eliana Bear, and on Instagram, Eliana T Bear ESQ, which stands for Esquire.
Cool. And I'll also mention that you have a great blog, which is really informative and really up to date with the latest cases, latest news on the topic of divorce and the law. So I would also tell people to Google and check out Eliana's blog.
Thank you very much. Yes, definitely check out the blog.
Awesome. Okay. Thank you so much, Eliana. And I hope we speak again, because there's a lot of things we just touched the surface and we could go so much deeper.
Absolutely. I could talk about these topics for hours.
Right. Just don't bill me.
That'll be $1 million.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, probably. Okay. Have a fantastic day.
You too. Thanks so much.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Let's Get Serious podcast. Please like, subscribe, and share this podcast with your friends and family. Help us reach more men in our community and help them navigate their relationships and build the best lives for themselves and their loved ones.